Thanks for joining us for the start of another busy week. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. By now, you've heard the stories about the international supply chain. It's in disarray, as labor shortages across multiple sectors have made it harder to load, ship, and unload the goods so many are now seeking as the holiday shopping season gears up. Ports, cranes, shipping containers, all are critical links in the supply chain. And how do the goods in those shipping containers end up in your shopping cart? Trucks. Truckers are the foundation of the U.S. economy, hauling more than 70% of goods coast to coast across American highways. And right now, the trucking industry is short by as many as 80,000 drivers. One solution under consideration? The American Trucking Association is backing proposed legislation to test allowing people as young as 18 to drive. Now, as the mom of a 19-year-old driver, I must admit that this was my reaction when I first heard the proposal.
No, no, no.
No, 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 no! No!
Trucking is an overwhelmingly male industry, but that is slowly changing. A 2019 survey from Women in Trucking shows that 10% of over-the-road or long-haul truckers are women, and that's up from 7.8% the year before.
Yeah, here we go again. Can you imagine having to be at work all day and listening to this beeping sound?
This is Gretchen Waters. She's an over-the-road truck driver and travels all over the country making deliveries. Right now, she's hauling dog food from Joplin, Missouri to Atlanta, Georgia. Now, that beeping sound is a motion detector, and it goes off anytime a car cuts her off. But despite that regular annoyance, Gretchen genuinely enjoys driving trucks.
I really like it. It's a job that you get paid the same no matter what you look like, no matter what age you are. All they really want is for you to be on time, communicate effectively, keep all the tires pointed in the right direction. And that is not hard to do, you know? It really isn't.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on. 10-4, Big Ben, for sure.
Trucking is not just about working on the road. It's about living on the road.
It's kind of like working from home in that, you know, you're living kind of in this little studio apartment situation. I personally, I sleep up on the top bunk for safety. If somebody were to break into the truck in the middle of the night, I would much prefer to be up above where they might not be expecting me and where I can try to deal with the situation from above. And I have a piece of like finished plywood on the bottom bunk, which allows me to cook, allows my dog space to be, it allows me space to roll out my yoga mat and work out and work on some of my arts and craft projects and stuff.
I love that Gretchen is doing yoga and arts and crafts on the road. But supply chain delays and worker shortages not only affect consumers, they also impact workflow for drivers like Gretchen.
It just means that it's a lot harder to manage the personal aspects of my life. It's harder to manage my time. Because this job really is a lot about discipline and time management. You know, there really are only so many hours in the day to be able to live out all different parts of, you know, who you are as a person. And that has to get worked into a lot of unknown variables, which already includes, you know, construction traffic, urban traffic, breakdowns in equipment. There's just, you know, out here you just really have to be ready for literally anything.
And while she does love her job, she acknowledges it can be draining.
A part of the reason that there is a truck driver shortage is that this job is not for everybody. It really requires an incredible amount of personal endurance and stamina, a lot of solid support in your home life. It really is a big deal to have a, you know, stable situation at home. I know a lot of people get off the road because, you know, they cannot be present for what's happening at home, which is just as important to them as what's going on out here. But the sacrifice that truck drivers make is that you are never anywhere, and you're also kind of never really at home. And that's a big reason why a lot of people can't stay in the industry and why it's hard to attract new new people.
Grueling hours requiring stamina, endurance, and sacrifice just might be part of the story of the truck driver shortage. Okay, so you know car talk? Well, this is truck talk. Now on The Takeaway. Jennifer Smith is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal covering logistics and the supply chain. Thanks so much for being here, Jennifer.
Hi, great to be here.
And Tiara Allen is a long-haul trucker who's known as the sassy trucker on social media. Thanks for joining us, Tiara.
Hi, thanks.
Tiara, I want to start with you. What kind of driving do you do and what do you haul?
Currently, I'm over the road and I haul exotic cars. I'm a car hauler.
Ah, and do you enjoy your job?
I love my job. I like the fact that I can travel. I like the freedom and experience I get to have while traveling. And I also love driving, so I really do love my job a lot.
Did you do other kinds of work before getting into this? I'm just kind of wondering what drew you to trucking.
Before trucking, I was a CNA. I worked in a little small nursing home and I take care of elderly people. I enjoyed that as well because I also enjoy tending for the old people. So I love that as well.
Are there downsides to the job? I hear you on driving. I hear you on kind of being on the road, having a little bit of freedom. Are there aspects of it where you're thinking ever, why am I still doing this?
Sometimes, but other than that, I enjoy it a lot.
All right. Stick with us. Don't go away. But Jen, I want to turn to you because I'm interested in what's behind the truck driver shortage.
Well, that's a big question. And it's one that's debated a lot within different parts of the trucking industry. So you'll hear big trucking companies saying at times, particularly times like now, when the demand for transportation appears to be exceeding the supply of trucks, that there's a big driver shortage. Then you have a pretty vocal contingent of folks, a lot of independent truckers who say, well, if you paid people or if you treated them right, they wouldn't churn in and out of the industry or hop back and forth. From a strictly numerical standpoint, the industry did lose a lot of people on its payrolls when the pandemic first hit. However, those levels have built nearly back. And right now we're down about nearly 8,000 workers in the trucking sector compared to what we were 2 years ago before the pandemic. So a shortage may be in the eye of the beholder, but what's happening right now is you have all this freight demand, all these imports jamming in the West Coast ports. There's a lot of unusual demands on the system that usually move goods around. So the truckers that they do have are spending a lot of time waiting around at warehouses, at port terminals to get loaded and unloaded. So that's also overall biting into capacity. And that's what's causing, if you're a person trying to hire a truck, you might say, why am I having so much trouble hiring it? Maybe they need more truckers, but they also need to use the truckers they have better than they are.
That's an interesting point. Tiara, have you noticed like that kind of workflow disruption where you're waiting longer in order to load the vehicles that you're transporting?
Yeah, sometimes I have to wait like a day or two to get things done because that's part of the reason why there's not many drivers, because we have to wait for a very long time. Sometimes we don't get paid to wait for those labor pays and things like that. And sometimes it leads to people to quit and not want to work because we're not getting paid what we deserve having to wait that long.
Oh, that's an interesting point. So Jen, talk to us about how pay works. So when drivers are waiting, they're not on the clock?
Well, there's a range, but many drivers are paid by the mile. And what's customary in the trucking industry, and some truckers don't like this, what's customary is they tend to, the first 2 hours waiting to get loaded and unloaded tend to be free in that the trucker isn't getting paid for that time. And then after that, sometimes a thing called detention pay kicks in, which is sort of an hourly rate. Sometimes truckers claim it, sometimes they don't. Sometimes the trucking companies they're driving for will pay them, or the brokers who arrange the loads will pay that, or they won't. Either way, it's often not equivalent to how much money they'd be earning if their wheels were rolling. So people like the head of the owner operators, Independent Drivers Association, say that the problem with trucking is that there's no value placed on a driver's time. So, you know, that comes down on people like Tiara.
All right. I want you to, Jen, to help me understand that just a bit more. When you say, so you used a couple phrases, I want to be sure that both I and our listeners understand. So one is owner operator. Can you help us to understand sort of how many truckers actually own their own vehicle? How many are leasing, kind of what, or maybe even not how many, but sort of what that generally looks like. And then when you're talking about the value of time, how that gets played out in the industry.
Sure. So the trucking industry, there's a couple different ways that drivers are employed. Some drivers work directly for a trucking company and they're called company drivers. A few of those drivers might get paid by the hour, but often the model is you get paid for mileage with, you know, maybe some ancillary compensation for waiting around. Then there's a pretty sizable group of truckers who either own or lease their own vehicles. And that's why they're called owner operators. Some of them might have their own trucking business with a DOT number and operating authority that allows them to move freight for other people. Other folks have or lease a truck and they work as contractors for big trucking companies and they take loads from them. So sorry, this is all a little bit mm-hmm. detailed, but there's a couple different ways that it works. And that's why you have some disagreement within the industry about things like whether there's a shortage or whether drivers mm-hmm. are getting paid enough, because you have the perspective of, say, a big publicly traded trucking company that's trying to make sure it's got enough margins to deliver a profit to investors. And then you have folks who are running one truck or two trucks, and they have a quite different view of how things are working in the industry.
Now, Tierra, you really are the sassy trucker. I've seen you on Twitter and Instagram. Talk to me a little bit about what it means to be a woman and a good-looking young woman who is driving trucks. Are people surprised when you get out of the truck? Are they helpful and happy, or do you face discriminatory practices?
Well, me being a young female truck driver, a lot of the people are surprised when I get out the truck. And some people are very helpful. Like sometimes when I'm at the shipper getting loaded and unloaded, they may offer to help me back up the truck. Sometimes they may even ask me if they would like to buy me lunch. So with me, sometimes I love that because I like the attention that comes with it and the benefits. And also I like how sometimes I'm at the fuel station, they even come over to offer to pump my gas. And since I do YouTube and I share my stories along the way, a lot of people from social media, they notice me at the truck stop and say, hey, you're the sassy trucker. I watch your videos all the time. I like how you inspire other women truckers to become truck drivers as well.
I wonder, Tierra, do you ever worry about personal safety as a result of that? We were talking with another woman driver who was talking about if someone were to break in, for example. And so I just wonder, when you're driving by yourself, do you still feel secure?
Feel secure because my truck has like a little alarm on it, a button, like it's called panic mode. It's in the back of the sleeper. So if someone comes near the truck, it'll just go off and it'll alarm my dispatchers that there's someone near my truck. So that's one thing that I do like about it. And also I use the seatbelt technique where you put the seatbelt around the door so someone tries to get in, they won't be able to get inside of the truck.
I love it. You've thought about those things. Jen, I'm wondering, in an industry like trucking, where you have such a high percentage of men, very few women, and we know that so many women have been pushed out of the workforce during the COVID-19 pandemic, if one of the things that's happening is that trucking companies might actually be seeking to recruit women, and if so, what they're doing in order to make that possible?
Well, trucking companies have been trying to recruit female drivers for some time. And in part, that's because they tend to have slightly better driving records, which maybe, I don't know if Tierra has some thoughts on that. But they've been pushing for a long time to try and get more women in the industry. But for the reasons that were outlined at the opening of the segment, you know, you're away from home a lot. And one of the reasons women have been pushed out of the labor force during the pandemic is because of the lack of childcare. So I know that trucking companies, they're certainly trying very hard to get women. They're trying to get younger drivers. They're trying to get veterans because a lot of veterans both have discipline and many of them might have driven heavy duty vehicles during service. So they're trying to get all these groups in. But that's something they have been trying to do because retention in the trucking industry has been a problem for a long time. And it's something that the pandemic is really exposing and showing some of the tougher parts of the job, including conditions where maybe you're delivering freight and you're not allowed to use the bathroom and you have to use a porta potty because of concerns about infection. So the pandemic is exposing issues in the industry that have been happening for decades. So I am sure they would love to hire more women. And I actually did speak with a young woman who had just started trucking recently in the last couple months, and she loves it. So there may be more folks like her and Tierra out there.
So Jen, I want you to walk through that, just one portion of that a bit more. So, you know, when we look at what's happening, for example, in the restaurant industry, you know, I can see the ways that restaurants are paying higher prices and they're reducing hours. Like there's ways where even on the consumer side, you can see how the labor shortage is affecting businesses, and businesses are needing to respond in part by raising wages, right? Something that restaurant workers have been asking for a very long time. I'm wondering, when you talk about some of these conditions that are being exposed, if the shortage and the high demand of the holidays creates a situation where truckers may get some of the things they've been demanding for a long period of time.
This is indeed the moment where issues in the trucking industry, if trucking companies or drivers have been, you know, wanting more pay or saying, hey, you got to be quicker loading or unloading my drivers, you got to make sure my trucks are on the road faster, because there's such demand for transportation right now, this is the moment to press those issues. You know, this happens when capacity gets tight, it does happen. But what you have been seeing really over the past year is that pay for drivers has been increasing fairly substantially. I think one estimate said that they're probably going to have across the board gains of about 8% this year. So that's something, and that's, you know, you see the market responding to that by the number of drivers and other employees that the sector has been adding in recent months. So there is a sort of response, but what does happen is you'll increase the shipping rates that you're charging customers, retailers, or factories to move their freight around. So that can sometimes translate into higher prices for consumers. It's part of these supply chain costs that have been rising over the past year, along with the increased cost for moving stuff over the ocean in big ships. Those prices have risen, and also the increased price of raw materials. So all of that could play into what you are seeing on the shelves at stores.
Tierra, I'm wondering, in your conversations, either on the road or in social media with other truckers, if there are things that that you all, as professional drivers, are requesting, are wanting to make your jobs better, more sustainable.
Yes, better pay, more home time, because home time really plays a big factor for us, because we're out here on the road 24/7. I stay on the road for about 2 months at a time due to the truck driver shortage. So with me being on the road longer, that means that I'm out longer, and we're not always getting paid what we deserve. So we put in extra work so that we can make more money. So a lot of us, we want to get paid more, definitely, and more home time.
Are you going to be working all through the holiday season?
Yes.
Out on the road.
Yes. I'll be all working right on the holiday seasons.
Well, Tierra, we all appreciate the work that you and that other truckers are doing to keep our economy open and to help to address these questions. Jennifer Smith, reporter at the Wall Street Journal on logistics and the supply chain, and Tierra Allen, a long haul trucker, also known as the Sassy Trucker on social media. Jennifer and Tierra, thank you both for speaking with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ah, the theme song from Taxi. For those of us of a certain age, the distinctive tune immediately invokes the opening credits of the late 70s, early 80s TV comedy, a simple New York yellow cab crossing the Brooklyn Bridge. And the yellow cab has long been an iconic symbol of the city, equally identifiable to New Yorkers, other Americans, and international tourists. What a casual visitor might not realize is that the foundation of these iconic vehicles is actually a very complex market. A taxi medallion is the physical certificate required to operate a yellow cab. And way back in 1937, New York City limited the number of medallions available for sale, making it a scarce commodity. And like diamonds and oceanfront property, scarcity raised the value of medallions. In 2014, a New York City taxi medallion cost about $1 million. It's a hefty sum, but for generations, the medallions were really a pretty darn good investment. So recent immigrants did what earlier generations before them have done. They faced predatory lending rates to access a medallion and entered leasing agreements to access vehicles. Hard work, long hours, commitment, they'd always ultimately been enough. But then, Uber, Lyft, and a global pandemic that halted travel. And suddenly, the value of the medallion plummeted. Once worth nearly $1 million, the New York City permit is now valued at just over $100,000. This is Queens local, Augustin Tang.
I chose to inherit my father's medallion thinking that I would inherit something that was my father's like bread and butter. And he was just so proud of owning a piece in New York. So I wanted to keep his legacy after he passed in 2015. My father was almost $530,000 in debt. And then I had to take it over. But I was just paying the bare minimum I can to bring it down.
Facing unrelenting debt with no relief in sight, last month, New York City taxi drivers began a hunger strike to pressure city officials to restructure debt. Last week, Mayor Bill de Blasio and other city officials struck a deal that ended the drivers fast.
Under this agreement, drivers will experience real substantial debt relief. It will allow them to move forward. These drivers deserve our respect, our appreciation as all New Yorkers.
The new plan includes restructuring outstanding loans to $200,000, which would cap debt payments at around $1,100 a month. And the city will be guaranteeing all taxi driver debts. In the last relief plan, the city was not a guarantor, and some drivers would have been forced to pay up to $2,000 a month. Here to discuss the hunger strike and what was won is Bayravi Desai, the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, the union representing the drivers. Bayravi, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
All right. Can you tell us a bit about the terms of this new deal?
Yeah, so we struck the deal with both the city and a company called Marblegate, which is a private equity firm, and it's the largest holder of loans in the industry. The deal is that the loans will be capped at no more than $200,000, meaning no individual will have a loan balance above that amount. And you subtract from that $30,000, which is a grant from the city of New York. That's coming out of a program that the city announced about 7 months ago. And that's all they had announced back then. And so we'll now apply that grant to today's terms. So the drivers would be paying off $170,000 at about $1,122 a month. And the $170,000 will be under a city-backed guarantee, which means that if into the future they're not able to make a payment, they do lose the medallion. The bank is able to take the medallion back and resell it. If there's still a balance left on the $170,000, then the city makes up for it. So the drivers will no longer be at risk of liens on their homes or on their bank accounts. They will no longer have to file for bankruptcy. They're able to get tremendous debt relief, a payment that is affordable, and protection against liens into the future.
So as we think about this and sort of how you finally got here, I want to talk a little bit about a hunger strike as a strategy. I'm wondering where the initial impetus for that emerged.
Well, you know, this was a more than 6-year campaign for us. And particularly over the last 3 years, we've had nonstop actions. We've shut down the Brooklyn Bridge a couple of times, you know, just halted traffic. The 59th Street Bridge, you know, we've shut down the offices of banks and just engaged in a tremendous amount of direct action. We were at City Hall for a 24-hour protest. We reached over 1,000 straight hours. And so we reached the point where, you know, we'd already done all the direct action that's really imaginable. We had built tremendous political support. The entire congressional delegation had been on our side. A number of city and state electeds were on our side. We had popular support, but we still were not moving City Hall. And we needed City Hall in order to engage the lenders in a three-party negotiation. And, you know, the hunger strike was really our last effort. You know, we've done strikes in the past, never a hunger strike before. I have to tell you, in 25 years, it was the most difficult thing that I've had to announce. You don't want to see your members have to engage in a hunger strike, but we were not going to lose this fight. We were, you know, we intended on giving it absolutely everything that we had. We needed to shock the consciousness for the city and the lenders to understand our sheer determination in winning this fight.
Can you tell me how many people chose to take part? And, you know, your point about how difficult it was to even announce it, sort of what some of that lived experience was. I certainly think you're right that it reflected the clarity of how dire this situation is.
You know, we had over 70 individuals take part in the hunger strike. We had a number of not just drivers, but, you know, there were elected officials, there were members of other organizations, and then just members of the public who in solidarity went on like 24-hour strikes with us. A number of us did it for the entire 15 days, some for like 13 days, 10 days. And, you know, drivers, the average age of drivers now is around 50. And a number of our hunger strikers among the drivers were in their early to mid 60s. Some had, you know, pre-existing health issues like diabetes and heart problems. A number have thyroid-related issues, so your metabolism is already really slow. We were being checked on by the New York City Docs Coalition, which is a volunteer organization. They checked on us twice a day. I myself, as the head of the union, received reports on how every hunger striker was doing. So this was an operation where, you know, we had support. This was very sensitive. This is not something that you can take on easily. There was months of planning that went behind it. People had to fill out a pre-screening health form. They had to go and have an appointment with their doctor. If they did not have medical insurance, we helped to arrange those appointments for them. And they had to really make a plan in terms of their medication, bring all the medication to the camp. We had to have medical backup ready. And, you know, I tell you, Melissa, as difficult as those 15 days were, we're now at a point of refeeding. So it's, you can't just go back to eating once you've ended a hunger strike. On average, the number of days that you've been on the strike, you cut those in half. And that's how long it's going to take your body to really adjust. For some of us, it's going to take the exact number of days that we were on hunger strike. So it's still going to be, you know, another week to 10 days before we can feel like our bodies have fully recovered.
I know that there will be some, whenever we start talking about debt relief, there are always some who will say that those who signed the loans, took out the debt, are to blame. But I want to hear for a moment again from Tang, who we heard from earlier in this segment, about being sold a dream. Let's take a listen.
They said, they sold us saying, oh, you know, invest in Medallion, invest in the city, you know, get into the middle class. You know, this is your American way, you know, American dream that you've been asking for.
Can you help us understand what he means there? What's that dream that was being sold?
So the city of New York issues the medallion, and they sell new ones through what's called an auction. So you have to bid. It's not a lottery, you know, it's actually an auction. So you have to bid higher and higher. And the city sets what's called the opening bid. So for example, in 2013, the opening bid was $850,000. If you had bid $849,000.99, you would have been disqualified from that auction. Through the years, the city issues the issues reports on the value of the medallion, and a New York Times investigation found that they had fudged many of those reports. They inflated the value when they publicized it, sometimes as much as by 11%. And the city allowed in financial institutions that were not allowed to loan after the housing market crash. They were still allowed to loan to the drivers. And so this was a real act of fraud by the city, and in hand with a number of financial institutions and industry players that engaged in, you know, in inflating the value. Many of those same city officials then allowed in Uber and Lyft without regulation. So by 2014, you had over 45,000 Uber and Lyft cars. By 2018, you had over 85,000 Uber and Lyft cars versus about 10,000 yellow cabs that were operational. And many of those same individuals, by the way, then went to work directly for Uber and Lyft. So this was a real, you know, this was to us a real criminal conspiracy, you know, has not been prosecuted as such. At the very bare minimum, it was incredibly immoral. And it set this crisis, which, you know, not only has led to financial ruin of thousands of drivers and their families, but there were 9 driver suicides throughout this tragedy.
So do drivers have a fighting chance of survival given the realities of rideshare apps?
Well, I think bringing down the debt to these numbers, yes, in the immediate timing gives drivers that chance of survival. There is still so much more to be done. You know, the despair that drivers as an entire workforce have faced, whether they be yellow cab drivers or Uber and Lyft drivers themselves, is that full-time driving has really been destroyed by the Uber and Lyft business model. You know, it's a business model that is out to eradicate, you know, full-time work. They believe, you know, they call it gig work, which is all about part-timing a full-time job. It's reducing the income, and you justify that reduction by saying this is only a gig, it's not meant to be a job. And that's been the heart of the despair. And they've done it by saturating the streets with vehicles. So, you know, yellow cabs get drowned out. Uber and Lyft drivers end up being placed in the back of the line for a dispatch because there's so many new people coming in. This is a moment for reset. It's a reset on protecting full-time work. It's a reset on how we address issues of transit justice for the public and for the consumer base, especially around race-based refusals and around the rights of our customers who have disabilities. It's a moment to reset the economics where the workers are placed at the center and not the companies or the banks. So there's a lot of work to be done, but this for us was the fundamental fight that would allow us to have that new day.
Bhairavi Desai is the executive director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
The population of Puerto Rico is at its lowest point in 40 years. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans have left the island for mainland U.S., an exodus that accelerated after the widespread devastation of Hurricane Maria in 2017. The remaining population on the island tends to be older. More than 1 in 5 Puerto Rican residents is 65 or older. And as we continue our ongoing series, Aging While Queer, we're looking at life for older LGBTQ plus Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico. I spoke with Wilfred Labiosa, executive director of Waves Ahead, an organization that supports queer elders in Puerto Rico.
I lived in Massachusetts for over 27 years, and due to a family health situation with my mom and dad, I moved back to my homeland, to Puerto Rico. And here in Puerto Rico, I noticed right away that there is a significant difference on treatment not only from the health sector, but also in the housing sector, in all the different sectors that impact the lives of our LGBT elders and LGBT community as a whole, from how you are left to wait for an appointment for hours at a time, to significant issues and discrimination in regards of housing, accessibility to food, et cetera.
So as you made that transition and saw those injustices, tell me a bit about particularly the position of elders within the community, given those inequities.
Well, in Puerto Rico has been faced with an economical crisis for the last 8 years. And right now we have a supervision board given by the United States to Puerto Rico, enforced to Puerto Rico, to manage their economical crisis. Since then, you have seen the impact in each of the individuals' pockets, specifically our elders. The elders have been impacted because the increase in medication copays, in medical visits, as well as in rents, etc. The impact of the hurricanes at the fall of 2017 made it worse. And then the earthquakes, then COVID. So it has been one situation after another that has impacted the economical day-to-day expenses of our elders. Our elders that are LGBT live for the most part alone, may or may not have a partner, and may or may not have children themselves. So they're living not only in San Juan, but across the island, that makes them hard to transport themselves into accessing services. And so you see how the transportation starts to impact because the individuals have to pay extra to use one of these platforms to acquire a private driver in one of those companies. And it starts then in the pharmacy, then it continues in the food, because all of our export and imports have been impacted by the hurricanes and then the earthquakes and now COVID, really the accessibility to products have lowered themselves. So sometimes you go to the supermarket and you may not have X or Y product. And when it gets to the supermarket, you have to pay double or triple the price that you would expect normally for that same product.
So you began in responding to that by talking about the kind of ongoing economic crisis onto which, of course, fell Hurricane Maria and the earthquakes and the COVID pandemic. But these things didn't just happen. They are largely a result, or at least many would argue, of policy of the mainland U.S. relative to Puerto Rico. I'm wondering, as you look at that relationship, sort of how you see where the responsibilities might lie for those economic crises and their disparate impact on LGBTQ plus elders.
One needs to sit and really see that our elected officials from the federal level to the local level have impacted in the long run, and now today, the policies and procedures and the income tax and the tax breaks that have been given to the rich and not to the everyday living citizen. Here in Puerto Rico, we have a Jones Act that really impacts still till today our pockets, and especially our elders, because the expenses go up, but the benefits that they have, the retirement could be, or it could be Social Security, have not gone up. So really the cost of living has increased because of all these politicians doing these policies, but the benefits and the earnings of these elders that may not work any longer keeps the same or have been lower.
Tell me a little bit about your organization, Waves Ahead, and its mission.
Sure. I developed this organization with other individuals here in Puerto Rico because we wanted to dedicate ourselves in supporting these marginalized and vulnerable sectors of Puerto Rico by providing them the aid necessary to stabilize them and to strengthen them. And the main focus is the LGBT elders. We are an affiliate of SAGE, and we manage SAGE in Puerto Rico, providing advocacy and services to the LGBT elders from our three community centers focused on the LGBT elder, but also providing services to the LGBT general community, as well as the elder general community. Our three centers, our goal is to be able to be in each part of the island so that from the centers, we can provide them now during COVID, especially to their home-based services, as well as services by the platforms in computer or by the phone or in a way hybrid. So if they feel comfortable coming to our centers, they can come. And if they can reach us, they can come or we go to them.
Talk to me about the specific mental health needs and concerns that you have experienced and seen as part of the work you've been doing with Waves Ahead.
As a healthcare provider myself, I'm a trained clinical social worker. I have seen the impact after the hurricane in our mental health of everybody in mental health here in Puerto Rico. Many of us could go through a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder because it has been one after another. And interesting enough, we have developed a campaign to educate individuals about, to take away the taboo about mental health, that preventive ways to be able to take care of our mental health. Statistics show in Puerto Rico that suicide attempts and death by suicide is largely over 80% in the older adult. It's very different in the States. In the States, this statistics is reflected among youth because of the bullying, because of all the different stressors that happen in society when you may come out of the closet or your daily living as a young person. Well, those same stressors, and even to a higher level, are impacting the older adult here in Puerto Rico. And they are using more mental health services. They're accessing emergency services because of their mental health. And they are unfortunately attempting suicide or dying by suicide. We want to promote mental health as a way to take care of it preventively.
Wilfred Labiosa is the executive director of Waves Ahead. Wilfred, thanks so much.
Thank you. Gracias.
That's the show, folks. Thanks for going on the journey with us, and we hope you enjoyed it. Now, before we go, here's a nice little note from Gretchen, the truck driver you heard from earlier.
So my home radio station is WUGA in Athens, Georgia. I've been a sustaining member for a number of years. I listen to The Takeaway. It comes on at 3 p.m. Listen online. One thing I really like about my job is it allows me to just really take in a lot of new information. It's really great having the freedom and stress-free, pressure-free situation in order to just be able to learn new things and open my mind. So I want to thank everybody who works in public radio for all the content that you produce and for keeping me company out here on the road.
And of course, you can also be a voice on the show. Or you can call with your show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Wear your seatbelts, use your turn signals, and meet me back here tomorrow.